All right, ladies and gentlemen, you are locked on Falcons. I'm your host, Aaron Freeman, and today we are doing a Thursday mailbag focusing on the causes for the Falcons' red zone improvement, as well as talking about whether or not the Falcons will be making any moves at the trade deadline.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
So you know me, I'm Aaron Freeman, been covering the Falcons for many years, formerly at FalcFans.com, RIP, still going strong on Twitter at FalcFans, contributing weekly content over at The Falcoholic, the SB Nation website for the Atlanta Falcons, and of course, the host of this illustrious Locked On Falcons podcast, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast, right here on the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. And today's episode of Locked On Falcons is going to feature a mailbag. We're going to answer some of the listener questions that we did not get to on yesterday's mailbag episode, where we talked about the All 22 from the Falcons film from week 5. We'll talk a little bit about what the film showed when we talk about the red zone improvement made by this Falcons team so far this season. We'll talk about all 5 games and some of the things that Arthur Smith has done and hasn't done to help improve the team in the red zone. Then we will be talking about whether or not the Falcons will be buyers or sellers at the trade deadline at the beginning of next month. And we'll explore potentially the trade market for someone like tight end Hayden Hurst. And then we'll get into whether or not Caleb McGarry is in line for a second contract. On yesterday's episode, we talked about Matt Hennessy's potential to get a second contract. And, you know, we'll also talked about Jalen Mayfield and his progress so far. But we'll talk about the third biggest question mark on the Falcons offensive line when we talk about Caleb McGarry. We'll explore whether or not he gets the 5th-year option. We'll talk about his potential market in free agency and whether or not his play so far has been as bad as some have billed it to be. But before we get into all of that, I do want to thank all of you guys for making Locked On Falcons your first listen of the day. I really appreciate that. Locked On Falcons is, of course, free and available on all podcast platforms, including Apple, Odyssey, Google, Spotify, and so many more. And of course, now Locked On Falcons is free and available on YouTube, where you can see this very handsome face each and every day, giving you the same content that you hear on the audio waves when you're on your commute in your car or working out at the gym or cleaning up the kitchen or, you know, trying to steal a minute as you put the kids down to sleep. However you listen to the podcast, Locked On Falcons is there for you, free and available on all those podcast platforms. So let's jump into our big topic of the day, talking about the Falcons' red zone improvement. And that comes from a question from Sports Sandwich, who submitted multiple questions. We answered, I think, 3 on yesterday's episode. We get one more on today's episode. But he asks, what is the biggest reason for the offense red zone scoring actually being good this year? And the biggest reason, Sports Sandwich, Mr. Sandwich, if you will, is that Cordero Patterson and Mike Davis are making plays. That's the biggest reason, right? The Falcons have converted successfully 11 of their 16 red zone trips through 5 games. That's good for a nice 69% conversion rate, which is tied for the 8th best in the NFL currently. 4 out of those 11 successes have basically been either a check down to the running back and or a run to one of those 2 running backs, where the running back was basically able to break a tackle and score. And, you know, you could technically raise that number to 5 if you really wanted to, if you wanted to count Patterson's touchdown run that he had against Tampa Bay, although I think that would be more considered to be a well-blocked run because you had really good blocks from Matt Hennessy and Caleb McGarry in space. But Patterson did make a defender miss in the open field. And so I think you could argue that as well. But we saw a check down to Patterson later in that game where Matt Ryan's initial read on that play was not open. He then escaped the pocket and then flipped the ball to Patterson, who initially stayed in to block before releasing into his route. And then Patterson made a spectacular, I think, one-handed grab, you know, high in the air and then ran it in for a touchdown. Then you had to check down to Patterson on the Washington game, where Washington basically blitzed in that week four matchup. And then Patterson was able to make the initial defender that was basically covering the blitz, where the safety had to come down because the linebacker that would normally cover Patterson blitzed on the play. And the safety, I think it was Landon Collins, came down. Patterson made that guy to miss and then made a couple of other defenders miss in order to score. Then you had the Davis score later in that Washington game, where he basically broke four tackles to score on a simple check down where Matt Ryan had pressure in his face on a blitz. Then you had the 3-yard run by Mike Davis this past week against the Jets, where the initial blocking didn't broke down. Davis initially ran to the left and Kyle Pitts was supposed to block a guy. He did not do a good job blocking that guy. That guy then hit Mike Davis. Mike Davis spun off of that tackle and then ran in the middle. And you know, it was well blocked. You had guys like Matthews and Mayfield doing a nice job on a double team off of the duo run against Quinnen Williams to give Mike Davis that room to spin off of it. But then basically Quinnen Williams wrapped up Davis at like the 1 or 2 yard line. And then basically the pile pushed Davis into the end zone. And then you have two more red zone scores for the Falcons where they were effectively rub routes, where you had the one to Ridley in the Tampa Bay game. And then you had the Zacchaeus one against the Giants. And that Zacchaeus play in particular was meant to be a fade to Kyle Pitts. That seemed to be the design of the play, but he was doubled on that play. And then Matt Ryan saw Zacchaeus breaking over the middle late on a rub route where he was able to get, you know, away from the guy covering him because Patterson went in motion and that drew the linebacker or the safety who was covering him. And that blocked the defender, James Bradbury, I believe, from being able to get to Zacchaeus in time. And Matt Ryan saw him and threw it to him. Then you had a blown coverage against the Jets on the Hayden Hurst touchdown. Shout out to Jared Wilson. If you listened to yesterday's episode, we talked a little bit about Jared Wilson and how much he helped enhance the Falcons' ability to win that game. And that was one particular play where he just simply blew that coverage and didn't give the linebacker help. And that's why Hayden Hurst was so wide open on that play. And if Wilson had at the very least done his job, he should have been in a position to make that tackle immediately after the catch. But Hayden Hurst just basically waltzed into the end zone. Then you had the fade to Patterson in Washington, where he just simply mossed Kendall Fuller, another outstanding play by Cordarrelle Patterson. Then you had the Pitts touchdown this past week against the Jets, where he was essentially mismatched on the defensive end, John Franklin Myers, who just got paid by the Jets, but is not a guy that you want covering. He's a pass rusher. And the Falcons were able to basically trick the Jets into getting into their goal line defense by using a jumbo formation. And that created that mismatch. Then you had the lead Smith touchdown against the Giants, where he essentially acted like he was blocking initially and then released and then caught the pass with the defense off guard. So I think there have been several plays where the Falcons have been able to successfully convert due to good scheming and good design. I think the rub route to Ridley, the Lee Smith touchdown, and the Pitt score were certainly good design plays. The Ridley one was one where Matt Ryan could have also thrown it to Olamide Zacchaeus on that play because they used a nice complementary routes in that situation where one or both guys should have been able to get open, and both guys did actually get open, and Matt Ryan just chose to throw to Ridley. And that Lee Smith one was a nice fake. You know, you're basically putting in your jumbo package and taking advantage of what the defense is expecting in that situation and getting Smith open in that. And the same sort of rules apply with the Kyle Pitts score, where the Falcons went with their heavy personnel, had a fullback and three tight ends on the field with Pitts and Smith and Jason Spriggs functioning as that third tight end. And the defense essentially didn't have any guys that could cover on the field at that time. You know, they could have maybe put a linebacker on Kyle Pitts, but it still would have been a mismatch. And so the Falcons were able to exploit that. And so it's not to sit here and discredit, you know, the other plays that weren't necessarily what I categorize as great scheming. But it just seems like several of those instances were the Falcons either doing a great job executing or the opposing team, shout out to, again, Jared Wilson, not necessarily executing particularly well in those plays. Or you could also throw out the plays where guys were missing tackles. Although, again, you know, how much credit do you give Patterson and Davis for making guys miss those tackles? And how much do you knock those players for missing those tackles? So I think certainly Arthur Smith has upgraded the Falcons red zone offense so far this year. But I wouldn't necessarily attribute the majority of what they have done and most of their success to brilliant scheming. I think there have been a few plays like that, but overall, I think it's really been, if you're asking the biggest reason, it's been Cordarrelle Patterson and Mike Davis making plays. So we're going to move the conversation forward from talking about guys making plays to whether or not the Falcons are going to start making trades. And we'll talk about the potential for this team to shop a player, particularly like tight end Hayden Hurst, moving forward on today's Locked On Falcons episode. But before we get there, guys, I want to let you know that today's Locked On Falcons is brought to you by Rock Auto. With ever increasing numbers of makes and models, it's now impossible for your local chain auto parts store to stock all the parts that you need. Why wait while the person behind the counter orders parts on their computer when you already have a computer with access to rockauto.com at home or in your pocket? Save time and money when using Rock Auto. You'll spend up to twice as much for the same parts when you order from that chain store or car dealership. Meanwhile, Rock Auto's prices are always reliably low for every customer. Rock Auto is a family business serving do-it-yourselfers for over 20 years. They have everything you need, from brake parts, tail lamps, motor oil, even new carpet. Go explore their easy-to-use website yourself today and find the solution to your auto parts needs. Go to rockauto.com right now. See all the parts available for your car or truck. Write Locked On in the How Did You Hear About Us box so that they know we sent you. Amazing selection, reliably low prices, all the parts your car will ever need. rockauto.com. So we have two questions related to the Falcons trading players. The first one comes from XL Sports at XL610 on Twitter. And the other one comes from Andy at Andy S. Gallagher on Twitter. Someone who people that checked out Tuesday's episode are very familiar, or, you know, if you're watching on YouTube, Monday night's episode, but Tuesday's audio episode of the podcast. It's going to be weird for me referring to which day the episodes, because the YouTube shows premiere the day before the audio shows, but I will try to keep it referred to the audio shows, because I, at least right now, the majority of you are listening to the audio version of the podcast, but we're growing. So meanwhile, subscribe to Locked On Falcons on YouTube. Anyway, XL Sports' question is, if the Falcons continue to have success or fail, could you see them making any trades to make the team better / trading players for draft capital? And Andy asks, one of the frustrations of the previous regime was the refusal to accept that a season was lost and try to trade players for assets. Do you see that changing, or do you think that the desire to remain competitive always wins out? You know, these are two very good questions, and I don't have a really great answer. It's hard for me to get a handle on what this new regime is and how they're going to do things, because when I think they're going to do certain things, they tend to zig when I expect them to zag. And, you know, I haven't necessarily started to figure them out. So maybe, I don't know. You know, we know the trade deadline is 3 weeks from now. That's on November 2nd. You know, unless they come out of the bye and lose those three games against Miami, Carolina, and New Orleans, and look bad doing it, I don't necessarily feel like they're going to declare the season lost. So I'm not sure that will be the reason for the Falcons to make trades at the trade deadline. But in terms of gaining draft capital, that is certainly, I think, a much more realistic possibility, where they might look at certain players and say, we can get something for this guy now. Why wait? But right now, you know, that involves the Falcons being sellers. And, you know, I think that's more likely than them being buyers at the trade deadline, simply because they don't really have the cap space. And one would imagine if the Falcons were really intent on acquiring better players, we would have seen them make some moves at the end of training camp. But certainly, I think the door is open for them to be sellers at the trade deadline. I know several people over the last week or so have thrown out Hayden Hurst's name as a potential trade option, given that the team will probably not have a high likelihood of trying to re-sign him after the season when he becomes a free agent. And trading Hurst would free up about $2 million in salary cap space this year. So that would, you know, at least give them a little bit more wiggle room in terms of their cap space to potentially then go out there and make a move for somebody else if they felt compelled to do that. But outside of Hayden Hurst, there aren't too many other players that I would expect to really have lucrative trade markets. Most of their tradable assets are either guys that you don't want to necessarily trade unless someone's going to come and blow you away with like multiple first round picks, or they're guys that probably have almost no trade market, right? You know, the Duron Harmons of the world. I don't think anybody's going to be trading for Duron Harmon unless Bill Belichick decides he really needs another safety or something like that. So, you know, I think re-signing Hurst, I wouldn't necessarily completely close the door on it. just because maybe the Falcons have kind of deflated Hurst's market enough that he could be affordable to them next year. You know, right now he's on pace to have 44 catches for 350 yards and three touchdowns, which is well below the 56 catches, 571 yards and six touchdowns that he had last year. And if you guys listened to the podcast before the season where I was projecting my stats for several Falcon players, I expected Hayden Hurst to have comparable production this year as he did last year, given that he would get more opportunities due to the Julio Jones trade. So I think in all likelihood, what is probably going to happen because of Hurst's deflated market, you're going to probably see him sign a one-year prove-it contract next year, unless obviously if he plays much better and much more productive over these next 11 games, that could change things. But we saw Gerald Everett, who was basically the number two tight end with the Rams the last couple of years and had similar production in 2020 to what Hurst is at least projected to have this current season, sign a one-year $6 million deal with the Seahawks this past offseason. We know that some of the reasons why guys signed prove-it deals was because of the deflated salary cap situation. But at least in theory, Hayden Hurst could decide to do that and say, look, I'm going to go to another team on a one-year prove-it deal, you know, give me $6 million or whatever the case may be, $7 million for 1 year. I will be your starter, and then I will try to earn a more long-term lucrative contract in 2023. At that point in time, though, Hayden Hurst will be 30 years old, and it'll probably be harder for a team to give him the long-term security that I'm sure he is seeking. So clearly the situation for Hayden Hurst, at least on his financial future, is not ideal unless his production can increase significantly. Now, the team that I heard people discussing was the Arizona Cardinals acquiring him, and maybe you could argue that a team like the Cardinals, particularly given their hot start this year, is a better environment for Hayden Hurst to go to in order to increase his production, in order to, start improving his potential long-term financial value. But I think you can question that specifically with the Cardinals, because the Cardinals' situation, even though they are losing Max Williams, their starting tight end for the rest of the year with a knee injury, the tight end position in terms of, as I understand it, in Arizona's offense isn't necessarily central to their offense, right? Max Williams spends a lot of time, like 50 to 60% of his snaps blocking, right? Now, Hayden Hurst has seen an uptick in his usual blocking this year with like 30, 40% of his snaps being blocking, which is higher than the 20, 25% he had last year in Atlanta. But you know, that would be a significant uptick if the Cardinals were to utilize Hayden Hurst the same way they use Max Williams. And the reason for that is because the Cardinals like to utilize four wide receivers more than anybody else. Arizona is the offense that far and away, compared to the other 31 NFL teams, could make do with an offense that doesn't necessarily have a high-level tight end. For the rest of the league, only about 3% of formations, according to Sharp Football Stats, involve not having a tight end on the field. For the Cardinals, that number is 25%. So they're eight times as more likely to not have a tight end on the field than any other team in the NFL. And when Kingsbury arrived back in 2019, that number was actually 35% of their offense did not feature a tight end. So I don't necessarily know if Arizona, even though they lost Max Williams, who was seemingly, you know, having a pretty solid year and has been pretty solid for them the last couple of years in that blocking tight end role and as an occasional pass catcher, you know, I don't think they're going to feel like they desperately need to replace Max Williams with a starting caliber tight end like Hayden Hurst, and thus give up the type of draft pick that the Falcons would probably want in order to facilitate that trade. You know, if any team is equipped to survive without having a capable starting tight end, Arizona is arguably that team. We saw that the Rams, with what they got in terms of compensatory pick going their way next year from losing Everett in the free agent market, was a 6th round pick for that type of contract. So if you're the Falcons and you're sitting here saying, okay, if we keep Hayden Hurst for the rest of the year, he becomes a free agent, he walks and signs that sort of 1 year prove it deal, we can reasonably expect a 6th round pick. So if we're going to trade him now, we need to get more than a 6th round pick. And so could we trade Hayden Hurst for a 4th or 5th round pick? Sure, that's possible. Do I think Arizona is going to be that team? Again, because of the aforementioned reasons, I'd be skeptical of that. I don't think they need to feel able to throw that level of draft capital, which is potentially a starter or a premium backup at that position. I don't think that's necessary for them to continue on their stretch run, potentially to the playoffs and whatnot. So that's kind of where my thought process is on specifically trading Hayden Hurst. But, you know, long story short, in terms of the broader questions, I don't expect the Falcons to be in the trade market at the trade deadline, but it's possible. You know, we'll just sort of have to see how those three games coming out of the bye week go for them. And we'll sort of have to see how the rest of today's Locked On Falcons goes as we wrap up today's episode talking about Caleb McGarry's potential to earn a second contract while also complaining just a little bit about Pro Football Focus grades, which I generally say about 80% of the time I agree with. But we'll talk about two examples that probably fit into that 20% of the time that I don't necessarily agree with him. So I'm sure 80% of the time, if not potentially more, you make Locked On Falcons your first listen of the day. But I will recommend a second listen, none other than the Locked On Braves podcast, with the Atlanta Braves now headed to the NLCS, advancing past the Milwaukee Brewers on Tuesday night. Find out what's next for this Braves team on the Locked On Braves podcast, free and available on all podcast platforms. So football season is underway and all eyes are on the gridiron. And as always, BetOnline is your number one spot for pro and college football action this season. With a new updated website and interface and even more odds, props, and contests, BetOnline.ag continues to be the number one source for everything football. Head over to the website or use your mobile device to sign up today with the promo code LOCKEDON for a 50% welcome bonus. And in case you're interested in tonight's Thursday night action, or tomorrow if you're watching this on YouTube, the Bucks are 7.5-point favorites in the Thursday night game against the Eagles. I don't necessarily love either team in that bet, but I did put some money on some props for this game. I put money on under 3.5 catches for Leonard Fournette, under 1.5 passing touchdowns on Jalen Hurts. I feel pretty good about that if those bets hit. But no matter whether you want to bet on some props or other games or other contests, of course, BetOnline is the fastest and easiest way to bet on all your favorite sports, from football, baseball, basketball, boxing, right to your favorite Vegas casino games. Don't wait and take advantage of the amazing offers available for 2021 at BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts. So our next question before we get into Caleb McGarry is from Christian Farholt at C Farholt on Twitter. He asks, was Mike Davis's relatively low Pro Football Focus grading justified? I thought he had a good game as a runner and in pass protection. So obviously this is referring to the Jets game. And again, I don't have any inside information into Pro Football Focus's proprietary grading system, but the best I can figure is that from watching and looking at their grades for basically now like 14 years since 2007. And I think they tend to be harsher on turnover plays. So in Davis's case, I think his grade took a big hit because of the fumbling of the football. I think his pass protection was hit and miss in the Jets game as well. And so I think he wound up with an average to below average grade there as well. So that also didn't help him in that regard. So, but I would generally agree with you. I think outside of, you know, maybe two or three questionable pass protection plays in that fumble, I do think Mike Davis had a pretty solid game and maybe potentially deserved a higher grade. But our next question comes from Sports Sandwich again. He asks, gut feeling, does Caleb McGarry get extended or is he gone after the rookie deal? So my gut feeling is no, Caleb McGarry will probably not get a second contract at this point in time, but it is possible. It just really sort of depends on the market and whether or not we see significant improvement from him between now and the end of the 2022 season. We can be pretty confident with Caleb McGarry that when it comes time to exercising his fifth year option next year, that the probability of the Falcons doing that is pretty low. You know, I think that's been probably off the table for a while now, and I wouldn't necessarily read too much into that as forward as projecting his potential in his future, as we probably would have done in the past. In the past, you know, a guy getting his fifth year option declined pretty much meant that the team was going to let him walk. I don't know if that's the case moving forward. But with Caleb McGarry, his fifth year option, according to overthecap.com, is about $12.75 million in 2023. I think it's likely when we look at that 2019 draft class, Chris Lindstrom, the Falcons right guard, will get his fifth year option exercise. And then you also look at the one offensive lineman taken ahead of Lindstrom was Jonah Williams for Cincinnati. I think those are probably the only two guys that of those five first round offensive linemen that will get their fifth year options exercise. The other ones being Garrett Bradbury, Titus Howard, and Andre Dillard, or six, I'm sorry, counting Caleb McGarry. So I think because of the changes to the collective bargaining agreement that was signed in 2020, changed how fifth year options worked. And so now that they're fully guaranteed, which means I think you'll have a lot more teams more willing to decline those options, but still keep the door open for them giving guys second contracts, right? You know, back in 2020, when we did a podcast talking about Tack McKinley having his option declined, you know, as a not promising sign about his long-term potential in Atlanta, we talked about how over the 10 years since the old CBA was signed, when it came to the first round picks and their fifth year options, we only saw one real example of a guy that had his fifth year option declined, but still signed a lucrative long-term contract with the team that drafted him. And that was Bears cornerback Kyle Fuller. And Fuller's option was declined because of injury concerns. And the way that the fifth year option used to work is that it used to only be guaranteed for injury, meaning that if a player got hurt, the team was then forced to have to pay that. That money was guaranteed. They had to pay that money. But if the player was healthy, they could essentially get out of it. And that's one of the reasons why the Falcons, going back to 2019, could have moved on from Vic Beasley before paying him his fifth year option, but couldn't do the same thing in 2020 when it came to Keanu Neal, because Neal got hurt the year before. But now with the changed CBA, they're fully guaranteed. So there's no way that you can get out of it. Whether the player's hurt or healthy, you have to pay that money once you exercise that option. And thus, I think you're going to be more likely seeing teams decline fifth-year options for their first-round picks, but again, leave that door open to still get a contract. We saw this happen this past year for the first time since happened to Kyle Fuller with Broncos offensive tackle Garrett Bowles, who had his fifth-year option declined last spring, but then signed a multi-year extension during the season 6 months later. And basically, for those of you that are hearing me talk about fifth year option and don't quite know what I'm talking about, the fifth year option applies only to first round picks, right? After a first round pick's third season, teams will have the option to pick up their fifth year of their contract, which means a fifth year is tacked on to their normal 4 year rookie contract that all draft picks sign when they get drafted, right? And so basically, that number is an elevated, that fifth year is an elevated salary, which is like the average of like the top 25 players at their respective positions. So, you know, according to Over the Cap's fifth year projections page, you can find out more information about that, what, how they calculate that number. But, you know, essentially for the Falcons, by declining McGarry's option next spring, he would then become a free agent after 2022. While if they picked up Chris Lindstrom's option, which I'm at this point confident they will, he won't become a free agent until after the 2023 season, right? So McGarry could still wind up earning a second contract from the Falcons if his play in 2022 before his contract expires is deserving of it. The issue is going to be, what is the market for right tackles going to be? And it's hard to project that, given that we just went through an offseason where, you know, the market doesn't necessarily going to hold up, because we're going to see increases in the salary cap over the next couple of years due to new TV money and all these various things. So it's hard to project what the market is going to be. But, you know, the market for right tackles, generally speaking, over the last couple of years has been raised significantly, right? That the top right tackles are now getting paid like second tier left tackles. They're making Jake Matthews money, right? Now right tackles are signing contracts that are making them $15 to $18 million a year. There's no chance that the Falcons, of course, are going to pay Caleb McGarry that type of money, barring Caleb McGarry becoming the greatest right tackle that we've ever seen over the next, you know, year and a half. But what you do see with the right tackle position is the second tier is considerably lower, right? For example, Darrell Williams signed a 3-year contract with the Bills this past offseason worth $8 million a year. We saw Trent Brown sign a 1-year, $9 million deal with the Patriots. And although these three guys are considerably older than what Caleb McGarry is going to be, we also saw guys around the age of 32, 33, and Riley Reiff and Ali Villanueva and Marcus Cannon all ink deals in that $6.5 to $7.5 million range. So, you know, Caleb McGarry, if he's in that like $7 to $9 million range, I think it's possible for him to earn that type of second contract with the Falcons if that is going to be what his market is potentially going to be. And I think at this rate, that is what you're shooting for if you're Caleb McGarry. You're probably not going to get a $12 or $15 million deal. You're probably hoping that someone's going to give you, you know, $7 or $8 million a year or something like that. And again, I think that is possible, but obviously he's going to have to improve significantly, particularly when it comes to his technique and pass protection, as well as being a much more consistent run blocker than he has shown so far this year. I think he certainly has the talent to get there, and we'll just sort of have to see where his development is over the course of this year and potentially next year under the Falcons offensive line coach in Dwayne Ledford. Now, I know there has been a lot of speculation recently that the Falcons may decide to move on from Caleb McGarry after this season, and I tend to be a little skeptical of that, right? I just think the level of investment that the Falcons would have to make in order to upgrade over Caleb McGarry is probably going to be a little bit more prohibitive for them. Could they go out and get an insurance policy? Sure. But I think you will see that more likely be on the cheap than necessarily the premium investment that you would likely need. And that premium investment, typically, if you want to get a starting caliber right tackle, right, if you want to draft one, right, free agency is different. But again, you have to pay money for that. Right. But if you want to get a starting caliber right tackle in the draft that you think is going to come in day one and take Caleb McGarry's job in 2022, typically you're going to almost have to take that guy in the top 50 picks, if not the top 25 picks in the draft. And so I don't feel like the Falcons are going to feel like that is worth their while to try to upgrade over Caleb McGarry and instead probably give him another year, assuming that his play does improve between now and the end of the 2021 season, that they will probably give him another year to see where he is through the 2022 season. Now, it is possible that Matt Gano could be that alternative option, that in-house option, that sort of cheaper replacement for him. But again, Gano is a free agent after this season, so the Falcons would then have to pay him a certain amount of money. What his market is going to be, I have no idea. I won't even sit here and speculate. But, you know, I think in terms, if we do not see Matt Gano come back this year and play, the Falcons would then be having to pay him sight unseen based entirely off of what, a month of OTAs, where they would basically have to make that evaluation or watching the film from previous years, which doesn't seem likely to me. So unless Matt Gano comes back and returns and plays at a high level for the Falcons, I don't necessarily see Matt Gano as a likely alternative option. I would love to see it, because if you've listened to this podcast on a regular basis over the last year, you have heard me essentially say that I think Matt Gano certainly has the potential to be an upgrade over Caleb McGarry and certainly has the potential to be a potential replacement for Jake Matthews long-term at that left tackle position. That's how highly I think of Matt Gano, but I don't assume that this new coaching staff is going to have the same opinion about Matt Gano that I do. So, you know, I think with Caleb McGarry, you could certainly have him, whether it's a Matt Gano or somebody else, someone come in and compete and push him for this job next year. I think that's certainly a possibility. But again, I don't think the Falcons, at least to me, are not currently on the trajectory where I think they're going to be desperate enough to want to upgrade that right tackle position, you know, to make a big splash at that position. And while I don't think Caleb McGarry is necessarily good or consistent enough, you know, I feel like we've seen good performances from him this year, last year as well. And, you know, getting back to my Pro Football Focus bashing for a second, you know, I don't think Pro Football Focus gave him enough credit for blanking Chase Young in that Washington game, because somehow Chase Young still graded out really well in that game, despite really not doing anything as a pass rusher. And Caleb McGarry graded out poorly, despite basically doing his job in that game. And I don't really understand that. Like, I'm not sitting here saying that Caleb McGarry deserved to get an 80 grade or something, or a 75 or something like that, based off of my film study of that game. But certainly a 57 did not necessarily mesh my observation of his performance in that game. And, you know, I'm often known as a Caleb McGarry defender, which is not a great place to be, because you're essentially defending what is an average player. But I do think the reason why I tend to defend Caleb McGarry is I think he often gets a worse rap than he necessarily deserves. And I think a lot of that stems from the initial barrier for entry, I guess you could say, when it came to the team trading up for him in the first round. And that sort of defined people's expectations for him. And I think even though, as I've said many times on the podcast, I think that that decision is justified by the fact that several players ahead of him, like the Tytus Howards and the Andre Dillards, in addition to several of the offensive tackles taken after him that the Falcons were leapfrogging in order to avoid drafting those guys, the fact that Caleb McGarry has arguably outperformed all of those guys means that that decision to trade up for Caleb McGarry is somewhat justified. I think you also have a contingent of Falcon fans that are not big fans of Caleb McGarry because of one particularly problematic tweet that he tweeted last year during the height of the George Floyd protests. And he did wind up apologizing for that. But, you know, I tend to defend players in general when it comes to, you know, some social media gaffes or whatever the case may be, because I don't necessarily think that we should be basing our opinions on players based off of what they tweet or what they post. Lord knows if people were doing that with Roddy White, he would not be as revered as he is in Atlanta. And it's just interesting to me who that sort of selective bias of who gets a pass and who doesn't. I guess for me, you know, my thoughts on Caleb McGarry is he hasn't really played great this year. I'm not going to necessarily say he's been outstanding. You know, he's been frustrating to watch. You get some good moments. You get those moments where he blanks a Chase Young. You get those moments where, Shaq Barrett is quiet in that game, at least as a pass rusher in that Tampa Bay game. He gets no credit for that. But meanwhile, you know, someone like a Jalen Mayfield, and I know people are going to say you just hate Jalen Mayfield, but like Jalen Mayfield gets a ton of credit for basically looking okay against like an Austin Johnson and a Danny Shelton in that Giants game. But Caleb McGarry gets no credit for basically shutting down Shaq Barrett and Chase Young in those respective games. So, you know, when I look at players like Mayfield and Hennessy, I understand that because of their youth and inexperience and the fact that they've only started 5 and 7 games respectively, that they are going to get the benefit of the doubt and people are going to believe, oh, these guys are going to get better, which, you know, history kind of tells us that anybody who's been around, watching football for as long as I have, which is part of the reason why I get my reputation, is like that is not as likely an outcome as I think a lot of fans assume. But, you know, because Caleb McGarry has started now 34 games in his NFL career, he is not given nearly the same amount of slack that those two younger guys are getting, even though I think there's plenty of evidence, as I've suggested, that Caleb McGarry has improved over his 34 starts. And we also know that it does take a while for offensive linemen to hit their stride, the better part of 3 to 5 years for those guys to hit their stride. And, you know, you couple that with our belief that the offensive line coaching was not particularly good in previous years under the former coaching staff and Chris Morgan, and that we believe that Dwayne Ledford, the new offensive line coach, is going to be much better for these guys. But you got to give it time. You can't, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day, as they say. And so I don't understand why we're willing to give, you know, I understand why, but I'm just sitting here saying, like, I don't think it's right that we are willing to give Mayfield an entire year of development, but we're not willing to give Mayfield. It's like 2 weeks. And if he's not, you know, playing at a high level, then he's trash, right? Like, that's what I'm getting at. So I feel like we do need to give it a little bit more time before we go, you know, fire and brimstone a little bit too much on Caleb McGarry. I think for the aforementioned reasons, he's not going to get that same level of the benefit of doubt or the patience that other players are going to give it to him for some of the reasons and causes that I mentioned earlier. That's why I generally defend Caleb McGarry, not because I think he's a particularly good player. I just don't think he often gets a fair shake from this fan base. Similar, you know, not the same degree, but similar to what, you know, Jake Matthews. Like, Jake Matthews will play 5 good games and then we'll have 1 bad game and everybody will come out of the woodwork saying, oh, Jake Matthews is trash and he's overrated and he's all these various things. And again, certainly not to the same degree with Caleb McGarry, but he doesn't get any credit for any of the good games that he does have. Like, you know, Tampa Bay and Washington, although I know the Tampa Bay game is debatable because he had 2 prominent missed plays in that particular game that people will focus on, but they'll basically ignore the other 50 plays where he pretty much did a pretty solid job. But, you know, I just think it's the same principle, right, with Jake Matthews and Caleb McGarry, where, you only notice offensive linemen when they make mistakes, but you never notice offensive linemen when they're actually doing their job. you know, I kind of lump Caleb McGarry into that same group with Mayfield and Hennessy as essentially bridge starters, that they're basically keeping the spot warm. I don't think any of these guys are long-term answers. Obviously, Mayfield and Hennessy will have more slack and more time to grow and develop, and they may wind up doing that. Of those two, I think Hennessy has the best odds, but we discussed some of the issues that he's going to have to overcome on yesterday's episode, so go check that out if you haven't already. You know, anybody who's been listening to this podcast regularly since the draft knows that, you know, I don't have a lot of optimism for involved with Jalen Mayfield. You know, I don't, when I watch Jalen Mayfield, I see some of the same issues that he has that Caleb McGarry has that holds back Caleb McGarry. You know, limited athleticism, stiffness, all these various things. And that was one of the reasons why I did not think Jalen Mayfield would last as a tackle in the NFL. But we'll just sort of have to see. Right. You know, I think all three of these guys are essentially guys that are going to be bridge starters, not long term solutions, but the team will probably let them sink and swim over this year and potentially next year before really feeling compelled to address, you know, the offensive line again with significant, at least draft investments, largely due to they have probably arguably bigger fish to fry, so to speak, other areas of the roster that they want to address in the meantime. And so they will make do with these young offensive linemen and hope that they will develop under the tutelage of Dwayne Ledford, which is one of the reasons why I think they brought in Dwayne Ledford to develop these young guys. So, you know, when I look at McGarry compared to Mayfield and Hennessy, I think as prospects coming out, when evaluating them coming out of the draft, I do think McGarry was a more talented prospect than either one of those two guys. And I think you couple that with the potential and ability that you can have to provide help to the offensive tackle with chips, that it does somewhat mitigate Caleb McGarry's biggest weakness to a certain extent, that you will not be able to really mitigate the weaknesses of Mayfield and Hennessy. Those guys, to me, you know, whatever those weaknesses wind up being, and you listen to yesterday's episode to hear my thoughts on what they are, you know, I think you can't really do a whole lot to help them out in that regard, but you can help out McGarry deal with his biggest weakness, which typically is slow feet, stiffness, and dealing with speed with that chip. And then you couple that with the fact that because you have Matt Ryan as your quarterback and he's a more of a pocket quarterback and needs to have that bubble to step up in, you're not as tied to having elite bookend offensive tackles as you are to having a really solid interior offensive line. And so essentially what I'm basically saying, my bias is that Mayfield and Hennessy not being good is going to cause more problems for your offense than Caleb McGarry not being good. And so this is all the contributing reasons why I tend to cut Caleb McGarry a lot more slack than other people do, but we'll see, right? You know, I have seen the struggles on film, and it is frustrating to see him miss blocks. It is frustrating to see the inconsistency and all those various things. But I do feel like of those three guys, you know, if one of those guys is going to be, you know, average and inconsistent, I think Caleb McGarry being average and inconsistent is the lesser of the three evils, is basically the point I'm trying to make. So there is my thoughts on that. Those are my closing thoughts on today's Locked On Falcons podcast. You know, I tend to run a little bit long when you get me talking about offensive linemen and whatnot. So there you guys have it. I appreciate you for tuning in. If you want to submit your questions for future mailbag and Q&A episodes, of course, you can do so on Twitter at Locked On Falcons, on Facebook at Locked On Falcons, or you can send an email to LockedOnFalcons@mail.com. And before we duck out of here, I do want to plug another show that you should make your second listen here on the Locked On Podcast Network, and that is, of course, the Peacock and Williamson podcast, where you get insight and analysis from NFL analyst Brian Peacock and former NFL scout Matt Williamson on all 32 NFL teams. Go check out those guys every day, free and available on all podcast platforms. So there you guys have it. I appreciate you for tuning in for another Locked On Falcons. I don't know what we're going to do on tomorrow's episode. I will see if I can try to get a guest so that we can pick somebody else's brain on this Atlanta Falcons team going into this bye week. So thanks for checking out another Locked On Falcons. And of course, subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform, and especially on our newest podcast platform on YouTube. Appreciate it, guys. Till then.